Welcome to the Buy and Build podcast, the show where we explore the nuances of buying and building small businesses with a focus on the UK and Europe. I'm your host, Paul. If you're interested in buying, building, or investing in UK and European small businesses, this show will dissect the strategies and insights of business owners, investors, and other deal professionals that I meet along my journey to acquire and invest in profitable small businesses. If you enjoy the show, please follow us on your favorite podcast app to stay up to date on all new episodes. And join the Buy and Build community at buyandbuild.co, where I share additional resources, deals, and ideas with the community. You can also find us on LinkedIn at Buy and Build and Twitter at Buy Build Podcast. This week's episode is sponsored by SME Capital, bespoke funding specialists for established SMEs. SME Capital was founded to support the growing number of SMEs who face difficulty or frustration in accessing capital through traditional methods. SME Capital was built by entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs. It's in their DNA. What makes SME a great solution for acquisition entrepreneurs is they're sector agnostic, comfortable financing asset-light businesses, and typically will not require personal guarantees. Also, their funding size ranges from 500,000 to 5 million pounds, which is often the sweet spot for acquisition entrepreneurs, but unfortunately, an often underrepresented part of the debt financing market in the UK. So check them out at SME Capital, where you can connect with one of their regional directors. And don't forget to tell them who sent you. All right, well, welcome back to another episode of the Buy and Build podcast. I'm here today with Rob Felters from Wolfgang Capital. So Rob, you and your partner, Carl, run Wolfgang Capital. And just I'll give a high-level background from what I know. It's a SME private investment firm. I think you guys have about five or six holdings. I saw you just closed one recently, I believe. We can chat about that. And we've spoken before, and I think I'm fascinated to learn more about kind of the holding company approach or the portfolio approach to SME acquisitions. So I think this is going to be a really interesting episode. And yeah, like I think this approach is unique in the UK. I don't feel like there's a lot of people taking this approach at the low middle market SME space. So it's definitely unique. So how I like to kick things off generally is just a little bit about your background leading up to the launch of Wolfgang Capital. And then we can dive into kind of what you guys are doing and your investment approach. So maybe you can just kick off with a brief background, Rob.
Yeah, no, thanks, Paul. So yeah, no, Wolfgang Capital itself was kind of founded out of an idea that I wanted to set up a business myself. My background is ex-military, kind of fell into rail consulting. And from there, you know, I wanted to set up my own business in rail consulting because I found I was quite good at it, you know, working with the major shareholders within Network Rail and major programs down in London and big projects across the UK. My wife, similarly, was from the same cut from the same cloth. So she said to me one day, why don't you buy one? And for me, I was kind of, well, I can't really do that. You know, I don't know how to do it. So that kind of was born of an idea that I would spend a good year learning the M&A market because I'm not from M&A at all. You know, my background, like I say, is born and bred in a little mining village from nothing really, and kind of always had this aspiration to want to do something bigger and better and kind of share a journey with, you know, with people where I kind of feel privileged to be a part of because it's something that you wouldn't necessarily do without that kind of knowledge or know-how or skill set. You know, it's something that takes a lot of effort to be able to do a transaction, let's say. So I spent a good year learning the market, putting offers out. So I put at least 35 to 40 offers out to market in the first year. Each one of them failed and learned something. It might have been valuation was incorrect, didn't get the right approach, you know, didn't do something right, you know. So every time you kind of learn from that and kind of adapt and tweak your methodology and how you can approach the market. And I was doing a deal at the time where I met Carl, whose background was kind of my missing link because I'm very operational. Carl's background was mainly at the financial services market, which, you know, is my weak link. So he was sourcing an ABL structured deal, an asset-backed lending deal for myself for a concrete and volumetric business down near Wolverhampton at the time. I spent months, like most people probably listening to this podcast, you know, trying to do a deal that eventually fell apart 3 days before completion because I tried to negotiate with three separate shareholders, which I know I never do. I always, three shareholders in a deal, no, it just doesn't work. Because two people, well, we'll go into that in a bit more detail anyway. However, you know, back to the original conversation, you know, for me, that deal fell over, but Carl had been instrumental in sourcing the ABL structured finance that I wasn't able to do at the time. So I got it up to that point. He then sourced the funding and the deal fell over subsequently, you know, 3 days before completion. Well, 3 days before drawdown on funds, actually. So SPA was drafted. I spent a good 6 months from initial inquiry all the way through the, you know, and I was kind of like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. You know, a year and a half, no deals done, you know, working full time, spinning numerous plates, you know, trying to keep your head above water, really. Like most people, you know, you do this as part of a day job because ultimately it's, you know, you've got to start somewhere. So I said, you know what, I'll just go back to consulting and start my original plan because it's just going to be easier than getting a deal done. That deal fell over whilst I was away on holiday. So I said, you know, while a week out, I've been, you know, slogging away for the last year, you know, every day, putting offers out, doing something, trying to push them into market, trying to find a way. And, you know, I was hungry for it. I got to a point where I was like, nah, I'm done. And then I said, you know what? No, reset. Let's go again. And Carl said to me, oh, let's maybe do a deal together because we work really well, get on really well, got same values, different backgrounds, same values, very family orientated people. So Carl's got 6 children. I've got 3. You know, for us, it's all about family. So we kind of got on really well and just clicked. So we ended up doing a deal. And, you know, 3 months later, acquisition one happened for us, which was, you know, in the medical services sector, very niche, providing operating lighting and operating theatre equipment to the NHS market. Very small, very niche deal. So private equity weren't interested. Nobody else was really interested because ultimately, it was so niche that nobody wanted to touch it. And from there, we've just kind of grown, done 2 deals a year kind of thing. It's just kind of gone from there, really. It's been interesting. Learned a lot of stress points, you know, a lot of highs, a lot of lows, like anybody trying to do, you know, in this space. So that's kind of in the background without waffling on, talking too much bollocks, to be honest.
Thanks for that background, Rob. Really interesting. I think something that resonates with me from what you just said there, and probably a lot of people listening, is kind of the struggles early on. A lot of people that I've had on haven't really talked about that too much. I try to talk about a little bit about my own process, but can you talk through maybe some of the learnings in that first year, kind of on the deals that fell apart? Like, was it you were structuring deals incorrectly or looking into the wrong sectors? Or can you maybe just talk a little bit about what changed and what you learned from that process when you kind of pivoted and then, you know, after you, I think you said you took that week off and kind of like came back?
Yeah. So, you know, coming from a non-corporate background in terms of M&A, you know, going to market and kind of telling the world who you are and what you're trying to do with no credible background of experience is pretty much impossible for most people. And I think getting your brand and the structure right. So trying to be something that you're not doesn't really work. So Wolfgang Capital looks very corporate in terms of its brand and structure. So if you go on our website, you can see on there, it looks, you know, quite corporate, but it kind of tells you who we are. It's been done twice over. You know, when I first started out, it was a bit more of a, you know, this is me and this is what I'm trying to do. And I had no deals. I had no history of previous transactions. So trying to get a deal done. And people say to you, well, what's your background? And you explain to them that you were just honest with people, really. And, people kind of open up to that honesty and work. You want to work with somebody that's not full of bullshit. You know, if you kind of have that approach with people, you know, and not try and hoodwink people into saying, well, this is what I've done when you haven't done it, it doesn't really work. And people see through it. And we see it all the time. People come to us now asking for advice or asking for something that they're trying to pretend something that they're not, which just, you find it quite infuriating because we've all got to start somewhere, right? You know, and I think being able to do a deal and get the first one done, it is difficult, very difficult. It's, I'd say, 98% impossible to get a deal done, but there's that 2% chance of getting something across the line. And I think that's changing year by year as kind of the baby boomer generation are looking to exit. So, you know, every day that goes by is another day where they could have gone into retirement and either sold the business or liquidated the business or done some form of disposal to extract the value that they've created over a period of time. You know, and there's a lot of people out in the market now that, like us, you know, early 30s, maybe late 20s, probably going, do you know what? You know, I could take that business. It's in that sector that I'm interested in, or I've got a current experience or skill set within that sector and can kind of build on what they've done to date and kind of take it to that next level. You know, I was quite fortunate. The business I acquired in the medical services sector wasn't a sector I was wasn't really interested in, wasn't a sector that I was real knowledge of. I feel like we kind of maybe got lucky in a sense, because, well, I say lucky, it was obviously 35, 40, you know, different deals going, saying no, 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 no. And all of a sudden you get a yes and it progresses to the next stage and that kind of moves forward. So, you know, I think you've kind of got to be interested in a sector that you want to acquire in. But at the same time, I've kind of contradicted myself, because I acquired a business that wasn't, because I was open to different opportunities. So you might miss something that's not available to you because you're so insular and focused on one particular sector. So as an example, I've been talking to a guy on LinkedIn who was talking about wanting to acquire accountancy practices, which is great. You know, if that's what he wants to do, then, you know, that's, I kind of, my advice to him was, that's great. That's what you're interested in. That's what you know. But also don't be blind to other opportunities that you might be on the fringe of that, because you're so focused on that one particular sector. And that's kind of usually our approach. You know, we'll look at most deals that are in a B2B kind of setup. You know, I'm not interested in something that's a trend, or, you know, B2C, or something that's in retail, just because it's so fickle and trends change and people's minds change and that industry is not really for me. So, you know, for us, if it's a B2B business and the deal's right, is probably, you know, my main advice for anybody that's kind of starting on this journey of looking to kind of go from the corporate world or some form of consulting world, or whatever, the, you know, whatever world you come from, really. You know, anyone can do it. If you've got the right mindset and you're willing to kind of put the hard yards in, really.
That's helpful. I think another thing I'm thinking about is, I'm curious to hear your thoughts. In my journey, the debt component has been the biggest challenge. And to what extent do you think having Carl on board, because I guess that's kind of his background.
So I think a lot of people, like, a bit like yourself, no offense, Paul, but, you know, you've kind of told me about your deal sounds overly complicated compared to how we would structure a deal. You know, you've kind of gone in the heavyweight in terms of trying to put, I think you've got a piece of equity going in, and then you've got kind of a debt product going in to kind of facilitate the management buyout / MBO, MBI, however you want to call it. For us, we kind of keep it simple, stupid. So we try and utilize a balance sheet in an ABL structured way. So if it's got invoice finance, if it's got assets, we'll utilize that as part of the deal component alongside available cash minus working capital and some form of deferred consideration. But, well, these kind of deals are quite difficult to do. However, we've done them, so it can be done. And for me, it's about building relationship and rapport with the owner, looking to exit, you know, and kind of getting them to buy into who you are and what you're trying to achieve with the business. You know, we retain all the staff. We don't make any major changes in terms of recruitment. So, you know, we try and recruit from within. We set up an LLP partnership model to kind of incentivize and build on the staff ethos and culture that's been part of the business probably for the last 10, 15, 20 years, you know, and take it that next step. So, you know, we kind of come at it from a different angle rather than most guys kind of going, oh, I need to get a, you know, a debt product, I need to get this, you know, and I need to get equity. Well, you don't, you know, you can do it simple, lowly leveraged, where you kind of maximize cash flow and you can kind of sleep at night, you know, because ultimately if you've got an invoice finance product going in, you know, it's lowly leveraged. So it'll unravel and it'll kind of unwind itself if something either goes wrong, which has happened to us. You know, we've had a business go into administration last year, which is, you know, quite tough. And nothing goes, you know, nothing's always plain sailing and nothing always works well. Lessons learned. And it was quite a tough year, end of last year when that happened, because put a lot of energy and time into that deal. And I'm not going into detail on this conference, you know, on this podcast, because, you know, it is what it is. But in this market, you're going to get burnt, let's say. So, you know, as much as you do due diligence, as much as you kind of do what you think's right, you know, sometimes you always get a bad egg, and that's what happens sometimes. As long as you can learn from it, adapt from it, and kind of protect yourself from the outset, you know, you can kind of come out of it stronger. So, and that's what kind of happened to us middle of last year. We had one business, like I say, through the COVID, through pandemic, kind of we ended up closing its doors, you know, which wasn't our intention at all. We had massive plans for that business to grow it and build on what had been done to date, but it wasn't the case. But, you know, we've come out of that stronger. We acquired a business 2.5 times the size, well, 3 times the size of that back in February this year, and that's going really well. We're executing a buy and build strategy in the new build housing sector at the moment, you know, as part of lessons learned from that, really. So I suppose you can be in for a bumpy ride is probably what I'm saying to people listening to this. You know, it's not, you know, you hear these stories that, you know, buy a business and get rich quick schemes. You know, I've seen a lot of coaches out there in the marketplace, and I'm not discrediting anybody that teaches this for a living, but, you know, it's not as easy as people make out. It's a longer game, and you've really got to be in it to the long term and want to have a passion for it, really, for it to work. If you're going to go at this half-assed, then, you know, it's not going to work. You know, deals don't fall on your lap, and you don't just, you know, you'll know from experience, Paul, you know, you don't just get a deal that lands on your lap and you end up acquiring a business, you know, 5 days later. It doesn't work like that. It's months and months of the hard slog, you know, and you don't get paid for that. You know, you have to wait till the deal completes to then hopefully, you know, have some form of structure where you can get a deal completion fee or, you know, a management fee out of the business to kind of pay for the last 6 months of work or 3 months or however long it's taking you to acquire. So yeah, that's kind of it really.
That's very helpful, Rob. I wanted to go back quickly on the structuring piece because I think it's really interesting. I think kind of the approach that I've taken, I guess at a very high level, is kind of like an LBO approach where you have a component of debt and it's a cash flow loan because it's an asset light business, which is not too unique. I think there are a few people listening that may have a similar sector focus where they're asset light. So it really only leaves a cash flow loan. And then on the equity component, a cash flow lender is not really going to issue a loan without an equity component. So it kind of pushes you to structure the deals in that regard. Of course, you do your financial model and you work out the debt service and things like that. And you want to make sure it's sufficiently covered. But so you mentioned for yourself, you're looking to leverage the balance sheet. So I'm assuming there's some physical assets and then mainly, and then in addition to the debtor book and then excess cash. So you kind of, I guess one first part of the question, using the debtor books are kind of like an invoice financing facility, and then kind of using the fact that they have this entrepreneur's relief for excess cash and using the combination of those two things for the initial payment without much equity.
It varies on the sector, to be honest. So we've done a deal on a compressed engineering business that does like air compression systems and nitrogen generation systems and things. And I think it was 85% that we got of the invoices released on completion, plus the excess cash on the balance sheet that we pay to the owner, plus a deferred profile over a 3-year structure. So we kind of top loaded that. So it was year one was heavy in terms of deferred, and it kind of filtered through to year three. It went to kind of, you know, almost nothing. So, you know, there's various ways to cut this. Yeah, I think it's been, you know, for me, about that creativity piece around doing a deal. We've got a deal due to complete at the end of this month, literally the next 5-6 days, which is part of this buy and build strategy. And on that, we're acquiring a competitor in the new build sector for windows and doors for the new build. These guys are based down south. We're based up north. So they're a competitor in the sense of what they do is exactly the same as us. However, in a different region, you know, they're down south, we're up north. We don't really compete, but we're working for the same builders. So that's Persimmon and Taylor Wimpey, you know, national house builders. But for me, that deal was originated through a supplier from us. They contacted me saying they're doing an MBO with the current management team where they've got a deal lined up ready to go, pretty much financed through an invoice finance facility. They've got a value agreed. Everything was done. They were heading to legals, but have a chat with these guys. So we kind of came along and we've offered the existing management team retained equity as part of this MBO. When we've come on board and taken, you know, we're taking 70% of the shares. They retain 10% apiece between the three of them, you know, and that allows the two exiting shareholders to exit and retire. But then we've got a strong management team there in place. Then we've then got cross synergies between our existing business in terms of knowledge, skill set, and the ability to then sort out our supply chain so we can obviously we've got better buying power when we go from our current run rate on that business is 15 million turnover this year. You know, that will then double almost to nearly, you know, 25 million will be our overall turnover for that group. And so we would have gone from 0 to 25 million in the space of 6 months, pretty much, which is a significant deal for us, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's exceptional.
I mean, that basically means that we'll own 10% of the UK market share for installation of windows and doors in the new build sector once that deal happens. So it's quite exciting. And that's where we see the growth opportunities is, you know, within that market as well. But yeah, no, like, kind of back to the thing, you know, you've been able to be creative with deal structures and thinking outside the box on how you can get stuff done, because there's usually an emotional lever that needs to be pulled, you know, in terms of, you know, why is it they're looking to exit? If it's retirement, okay, well, why? What is it that they're looking for to enable them to do that? Is it the value? Chances are it is, but also, well, the guys we talk to, well, what's happening with the staff? What are you doing? What's your plan? You know, they don't want a 10-page dossier on what you're going to do post-transaction. They just want to know, you know, nuts and bolts. Day one, this is what you're doing, you know, and a bit of a 90, well, people say 90-day plan. I don't really like using that term because things constantly change and your plan could move. You know, your plan that you've got in your head on for your 90 days post-transaction could completely turn around. You know, have to think on your feet because businesses are a moving beast, you know. So yeah, it's creative deal structures, I think, are the way to go. Minimizes risk for yourselves, and also it shares the risk between the exiting shareholders as well. Ultimately, it's an SME in a space that can be quite volatile at times. You know, the UK market is, well, not I say volatile in the sense of, you know, things can go wrong. You can lose a major customer, or, you know, something can happen with the supply chain, like so Ukraine at the moment, price increases, you know, things like this that are unforeseen that then puts a strain on the deal structure that you've already got. You know, if you've got a debt product in there, like you're looking to do, and something happens, you know, you're going to be quickly struggling to repay your financial covenants that you've agreed with your lender. You know, you're going to be sweating quite quickly. Whereas you do it on an ABL structure, it becomes a little bit less intensive in terms of financial reporting and, again, being able to kind of sleep at night.
I mean, it's very interesting to hear how you think about the deal structures, because I think, you know, you've mentioned it's not easy to find deals like this, but when you do structure them like this, it can be a lot simpler, a lot easier, make you sleep better at night. I think this is really helpful because at least my background kind of leads me towards kind of, you know, like the classic LBO type of structure, but there's so many different ways to do it. And I think you're a great example of someone who's doing it differently, but doing it successfully. So now you've done a handful of deals, and I guess a hot topic in the UK is kind of the sourcing of deals. And it's hotly debated because listed deals are often overvalued, and you've executed a few of these and you've kind of used a more creative deal structure. So maybe a two-part question again. How have you typically sourced these deals? And then how do you navigate kind of the broker intermediary when you're structuring these deals? Do you get some pushback in kind of structuring that the deals in this way also?
Yeah, so answer to your first question, a lot of people in the market I've seen saying use your direct approach, you know, direct mail, and, you know, which I've never done it personally. I've never once sent a direct mail to a business owner saying, interested in acquiring your business, you know, give me a call. I think, you know, people look at them and just think, what a load of bullshit. It's true. You know, lots of people are doing it. I've had them. Some of the stuff that gets churned out, I think it's offensive, you know, because I don't know. I just don't agree with it personally. It's not working. I'm not taking that approach. Maybe it would work for me if I did it, but I've not needed to. Our approach, my initial approach was through cutting my teeth on KBS and Benchmark, which were, let's be honest, I don't want to be sued for litigation, but, you know, I don't particularly, let's just say, I don't rate their services in terms of what they provide. I think they're overvalued, as you just said, but it's a good way to kind of get IMs quite easily and look at how you would value a deal, structure a deal, and practice on stuff that you will probably never acquire, because the expectation from the owners have been set at a 10 times multiple of EBITDA plus net assets. And, you know, it turns out they're a fence painting company or something. You know, it doesn't warrant that value. It's you see it all the time. I've even had email chains sent to me by accident from these brokers where they've been talking with their clients saying, oh, well, you told me I'd get 7 times, 8 times EBITDA. It was literally a fencing company. And I was like, guys, you know, this is, you're in construction. You're looking at a typical 3 to maybe 4 times if you're lucky, but they don't want to know it. But again, it's a good way to kind of cut your teeth and kind of learn the market, is what I did initially. And then as we kind of became more adverse to kind of understanding the market and building the brand, and, you know, got our first deal was done through a corporate finance boutique, which our presentation was right, our honesty, you know, the way we approach the market is what I revert back to, you know, we're not trying to bullshit people. We told them who we were, you know, this is my background, this is Carl's background, this is what we're trying to achieve. And we got a deal done because the owner at the time wanted to exit, and we presented a decent offer that was, you know, I think it was 3.5 times EBITDA at the time, and it worked. That for us was, you know, that deal does, that business itself turns over less than 1 million, but makes about 340K EBITDA, you know, on our first deferred, that was a deferred deal as well, you know, so we put an invoice finance structure in. But as you can imagine, with low turnover, obviously the invoice ledger was fairly low. So it was that plus excess cash and a deferred consideration piece over a 4-year profile, which we've paid him out every 6 months since we've acquired the business nearly 3 years ago. So he's had his money every 6 months on the bang on time, and he seems to be fairly happy. He's out of the business now. I get a text message every 6 months saying, thank you for my payment. So, you know, it can be done and it does work.
This is excellent. I mean, I think again, that's another really good example of kind of the deal structure that has worked. You know, you basically leveraged that debtor book, a little bit of excess cash, and then the rest has been deferred, and you managed to get that done. And then back on the sourcing piece, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. So on that with the sourcing piece, you know, my advice would be to build your brand and kind of look for a different alternative way to the market rather than doing what everyone else is doing. I'm a firm believer that, you know, you see these guys churning out property courses, for example, you know, get rich quick on a property course and all this bullshit. You know, and everybody does it because everybody thinks that's the next thing. You know, and I'm slowly starting to see the, you know, this market becoming that, because there's all these people selling these courses and seminars on how to acquire a business. And my first question is, well, why the fuck are they doing this when they could be buying a business and spending their time doing what they, you know, practice what you preach. And there are some people out there that are doing that. You know, I've seen some people doing courses that, you know, have actually got something tangible behind them and a long history of doing deals, which is fair enough. But there's a lot of people out there that you actually look at what they've done and it's just, you know, selling courses is how they make their day to day. And I'm a bit worried personally that the market will become saturated with people that just get rich quick and think, oh, well, I'll just set up a website and I'll just pepper gun the market with who we are and not have a structured approach. And it'll just ruin it for everybody else, because there are these people out there doing it. I've seen it. I've had one guy in America trying to utilize our name and brand, trying to approach certain brokers in America, and it kind of got back to me through that network I had over there at the time. You know, so it does, you know, people are doing it, and it pisses me off, because there's a lot of good businesses for sale at the moment where if the owners were sensible, and a lot of them can be if they've been educated in terms of M&A and how a corporate deal would work, a deal can be done with any business. It's just that mindset of if they've been led down the garden path with the wrong broker and they've got, you know, an unrealistic expectation on value versus, you know, what's actually happening in the real world. You know, you could do a deal all day long. You know, we've got a deal at the moment where it's been approached to us. Business turns over 3.5 million, makes over £1 million profit, which is, you know, phenomenal. They're looking at liquidating the company because he just wants to realize £4 million worth of cash on the balance sheet. Yeah, you know, and he wants to close his doors. And I'm like, this is criminal. Because ultimately, you know, you're going to let all these staff go. You've got a business that makes good money. You know, do a deal with somebody that could take that business on, you know, trade it to a point where they get something out of that. They can extract the value, and at the same time, somebody else can take the reins and kind of build on that, you know, over the next 3, 4, 5 years and maybe flip it. Or, you know, it depends what you want to do, what your aspirations are. If you're wanting to do that, or if you're wanting to kind of buy a business and kind of be an owner manager, you know, and kind of get away from the day to day of working for somebody else, you know, it's a good way to do that as well. You know, it doesn't have to be an all sexy buy and build strategy or multiple company purchases. You know, you might just be, do you know what? I've had enough of this. I'd love to buy a business that's in the sector I like, and I'd like some advice, you know. But some people go to the wrong thing and they pay for these. I've seen one guy charging 60 grand a year for learning how to buy a business. And I think, you know, if you've got 10 people a year, that's 600 grand. No wonder he isn't, you know, sailing around the world every day. You know, not actually buying businesses.
And good luck when you have to start paying fees for that actual acquisition and you've already paid 60K just to learn how to do it.
Yeah, and I find it pisses me off because there's, like I say, people like yourself that are genuinely wanting to do this and have found your own niche and doing like the podcast, for example, trying to reach out to people and trying to build that community of like-minded individuals, because it's ultimately, like I said to you on a previous call, you're trying to do something that probably 1% of the UK population have probably got an interest in doing. At the same time, out of that 1%, there's probably 5% of them that are actually doing something like this, because it's so niche and so difficult and, you know, so time consuming. It's not easy. So it becomes quite a lonely place if you haven't got a partnership, like I said to you before, or you're kind of trying to struggle through by yourself, you know, because if you haven't got the skill set or the knowledge, you know, anything can be a stumbling block if you don't understand things or can't see things for, you know, I've been talking to a friend of mine who's just acquired a warehousing business, very small, you know, it's a guy's been trading this business for a year and he had a dispute with a shareholder. So he's come and said, I'll buy you out. And we've done it. I said to him, advised him on how to do that with putting no money in really. So he's done that deal now. He messaged me the other day saying it's all gone through. You know, it's not phenomenal. It's not a deal where it's turning over millions of pounds a year and he's making, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands a year, but it's a solid foundation for him to get there. It depends how you want to cut the cake, you know. It's probably where I'm going with it.
Yeah, there's so many approaches to kind of executing this small business acquisition environment. And I think what you're doing is interesting because you're taking this kind of portfolio approach to it. So maybe it's a good place just to talk a little bit about that. In terms of the clear benefits of owning multiple companies versus one, or having more than one vertical, if you will, because maybe, you know, you're doing buy and builds in one or two sectors. Can you talk about some of those benefits?
Yeah. So for me, number one benefit really is risk mitigation. So owning multiple businesses in multiple sectors minimizes the risk of something going wrong. Even though it's something's happened to us already, you know, it's again, it proves the point that ultimately if all the businesses were in that same sector, then I probably would have had a significant issue during COVID and when the shutdown happened in construction and all that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, for us, it's, well, sorry, for us and for myself, it's mainly having that for me is quite significant that ultimately, you know, if one sector that we're in has, you know, recession hits or something happens in the UK market, you know, not all them sectors are going to be affected, you know, unless there's something, you know, World War III or something ridiculous. Even then, something, you know what I mean? It's one of them where you think, you know, if something happens in construction, I'm in medical services and logistics and warehousing. I'm also in, you know, other sectors. So you're kind of protecting yourself. And then for me, it's also the ability to learn lessons from different sectors and the implementation of them lessons within a different sector. So, you know, I've learned something, I'll learn things every day, but, you know, I'm learning different processes and procedures and how something would be done in the medical services profession in terms of that type of business. And then you go into a construction business and obviously it's completely different. However, you're going into it with, you know, multiple experiences from different sectors and going, well, actually, have you tried this approach? Have you done this a different way? Or, you know, and it kind of gives you that holistic view of how you can kind of look at things and go, actually, you know, there's a better way of doing something and improve something and it make it more efficient by having that experience and a broad skill set. You know, that for me is probably the two main things that I've found.
It kind of sounded there, Rob, like you're taking a more of a strategic kind of chairman role to the portfolios of companies and kind of leveraging lessons learned across the portfolio. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, first, am I right, I guess? And two, kind of how are you incentivizing existing management while you kind of sit at a higher level?
Yeah, you are correct. We know. I personally don't want to be involved in the day-to-day running of, you know, I can't do that across five businesses in different sectors. My head would implode. And probably the businesses as well, because ultimately, you know, I can't be in five places at once. So we have a management team in place that's usually a second tier management team or structure that's already in, you know, their pre-deal. If it's not, we'll make sure we've built it in as part of the transaction. So there's a handover period of usually 6 months. You know, we always say if we haven't done a handover in 6 months, we're not doing our job properly. We normally put somebody in place, if you know, or promote from within. And part of that, we, like I say, we implement the partnership model. So each member of staff has the opportunity to join the partnership and work with us in terms of incentivization of and growing the culture. That for me is very important that we have that in place. And most businesses we acquire, you know, the business owner is usually fairly hands-on and has got a team around him that have been there for, you know, many years. They're probably looking to step up and have been desperate to step up for the last 10 years. But obviously it's a bottleneck. So we kind of release that bottleneck. He, you know, the top co, you know, exits and they normally replace them with a, you know, a sound strategic plan from us to kind of go, right, okay, this is what we're going to do post deal. And this is how we're going to execute. We then set parameters and say to them, okay, this is what we want you to do. Get on and do it. I don't want you to, I'm not a micromanager. I personally can't stand micromanagement. I think it's most counterproductive thing on the planet, but as long as you put parameters in place for people to work within, people generally do, and they have that freedom then and accountability as well to then make them decisions autonomously almost. So as an example, one of our businesses, you know, is looking to recruit a new member of staff. So the MD of that business, who we put in place literally 3-4 months ago, he's kind of come to us and said, look, guys, this is what we need. This is the justifications behind it. What do you think? And we'll give him our, you know, our advice and say, well, you know, what one, why is it happening? What, you know, you provided us information, but for me, it's kind of the ability for them to then make them decisions without feeling like they've got to come to us with everything. And most of the businesses we've acquired, they've had that micromanagement approach previously, and it's always been a bit of a test, you know, a testing time for the staff when we come on board and it's get on with it. You know what you're doing. You've been doing it a long time. These are parameters you're working within. If you need me, call me. You know, we normally go down to businesses and visit them when we can. If there's an issue, we'll be there, you know, and we'll deal with it. You know, we're on the coal face for things like that. But ultimately, you know, they have the accountability to make them, and it empowers people really. And they're more productive for it. And I would say to them, you know, if you make a decision based on what you think is best and you generally believe that with your, you know, wholeheartedly, that's the best decision for the business and it's not, and it goes fucking wrong, then we're not going to scorn you for that because you've made a decision, you know, and you made a decision that you thought was the best avenue for the business. You know, if people are cutting corners and just being lazy and just, you know, just trying to have a free ride and, you know, I'm not interested in that, they'll quickly see the back of us because, you know, that's not what we're about. It's about a team approach and, you know, we're on a journey and we want people to be on that with us, hence why we incentivize and want people to build and kind of grow rather than just being left to run the day to day. It's more of a, well, what do you want to do? You know, well, I want to do this. Okay, well, let's build steps to allow you to do that. So people are on that journey with us. And, you know, we've had a few occasions where people aren't and they've got off the bus quite quickly, but they get found out. That's how we operate, really. It's quite strategic, but at the same time, the ability to dive into the detail when needed, you know, because ultimately we own the businesses, we own the shares. And, you know, for me, I'm solely, you know, me and Carl are 100% accountable for people's livelihoods. So, you know, if I need to be there 6 a.m. to deal with a problem, I'll be there. You know, it's kind of our approach to things, really.
I mean, that's interesting how you approach it. I think it'll resonate with a lot of people. And something that's, I guess you touched on it there, but the partnership model, because I think acquiring a business where you don't maybe have the sector expertise and kind of taking a decentralized or a more hands-off kind of strategic approach, you obviously want to keep people incentivized. So do you mind talking a little bit about that? Like, does that sit at the SPV? There's some kind of like equity share, or how is that structured practically speaking?
Yeah, so the LLP structure is separate to the limited company. Then we have an operating license that allows the LLP members to basically transact and do work on behalf of the limited company. So limited company shares are owned by Wolfgang Capital, but then every month we would then share potentially financials with the business. It's watered down financials. I don't want to give them everything because too much information can be a bad thing, but we give them headline figures. That's where we're at, guys. Is what we, you know, most people never get that. You know, most companies we've kind of acquired, what do we turn over? Don't know. What profit do we make? Don't know. You know, nobody knows. They're flying blind. So now we share that information. We share turnover, where we were last month, where we are this month, and kind of forward order books and things like that. So people can see growth or potentially see a downturn, you know, and if there's issues, then people are aware of it. And for me, that works really well. It's quite important to different approach because, you know, they say sharing is caring, but it's you got to be careful what you share because, like, say, if you share the wrong information and you share a whole P&L and balance sheet with all the staff, that'll just, you're open a can of worms, let's be honest, because people just dissect everything and ask millions of questions around everything because nobody might not understand it or, you know what I mean? It's, but the LLP is separate to that. So we'll say, okay, the business has made, say, I don't know, 100K this quarter. Out of that, we've allocated 10,000 to the staff. So you've all got a £500 bonus this quarter or whatever it may be, you know, and that's how we operate. So they get that. There's no equity piece as such. It's more of a partnership model that's separate to the limited company. And the benefits of that, again, is P11D taxes are non-existent, you know, national insurance savings, PAYE savings, which again help with cash flow and help build on, especially if you've got a deferred structure and you've got debt costs, you know, if your PAYE costs are minimized by a partnership model. You know, one, you can pay staff more and you can recruit more, you can retain more. And at the same time, you can also, it gives you headroom within the deal as well, if you need it. I wouldn't do a deal based on that, but, you know, it's always an added benefit.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I've never heard of that, but it sounds like not only is it good for incentivizing, but clearly has some kind of financial benefits too, you know, just from cash flow. Very interesting.
Yeah, financial business benefits at the same time. Yeah. As an example, you can move your, you can defer VAT between the limited company and the LLP. So you have a cash flow saving. So if your quarterly VAT bill is say 100 grand, you know, you can move that to the following quarter offset against the LLP. So you're not paying VAT for like three quarters of the year. So you're saving yourself 300 grand in cash flow. You can only do that once before it triggers a VAT audit. Yeah. So it's just again, it's just little things that we've had exposure to that we work that works well for us, and we implement because it's, you know, for me it's a culture thing. You know, yes, there's cash flow savings, but the culture as well. You know, people talk about not wanting to work for big corporate, you know, and they want to have something that's more tangible. Especially this generation seems to be more of a, you know, want to build something and do something. So it's a great way to kind of use it as a tool that people get, you know, not just an employee, you're a partner now, you know, and John Lewis do it, John Lewis and Partners. And we also, you know, similar kind of model, but on a smaller scale based for the SME sector. So, you know, that's what we do. And we, like I say, we use a company in London that do it for us in terms of the day to day. And they kind of make sure it's all compliant with HMRC and everything else like that. And everyone's got contracts and, you know, it's all done properly. It's not just a, right, you're a partner now, guys, and crack on. It's, and there's a two-part contract process where they get things moved over and things. It's quite detailed, but happy to share that information.
This is excellent stuff, Rob. I think the structuring, the incentivizing, all of this is really unique and really interesting. So just keeping an eye on the time, what's next for Wolfgang Capital? So you guys have made a handful of acquisitions now. What's the long-term goal here? Do you ever plan on selling anything, publicly listing, or is it mainly a long-term hold and cash flow approach?
Yes, it's a mixed bag, to be honest, because we certain businesses we probably wouldn't sell. We'd probably hold them for a while. But, you know, let's be honest, if someone came along and offered us reasonable value and we'd gone from buyout to 4 years later, you know, and we've now got cash in the bank that we want to extract ourselves and want to recycle that, then we probably would. Probably looking at potentially like an employee ownership trust kind of implementation, or maybe one of them as well, because the staff run the day to day. We have very little involvement in one of them to a point where I've not been there for months and they just get on with it. So, you know, that for me would be the ultimate reward in terms of not just for us in terms of value extraction, but also the reward for the staff of doing that and then actually getting what they probably should have got 4 or 5 years ago and done it themselves, but they didn't have the confidence to because they didn't have the information. They didn't know, you know, whereas we've kind of slowly drip feeding them information. So they hopefully a few years time will be ready to take that role and responsibility on if they wish to do so. You know, at the same time, the buy and build strategy in the new build sector, I think is where we see the value at the moment. And, you know, for me, I would like to do some form of IPO or reverse merger or whatever it may be to kind of, and they've done that. So it's one for experience and two to kind of create value. But yeah, I don't know, to be honest with you, mate. It's more of a, you know, I'm 32 years old and, you know, I've been doing this 3.5 years now, nearly 4 years. So kind of very early stages still and got a lot to learn. So I've got a plan in mind in terms of what I want to do with my family and things. You know, that's a different question. But, you know, in terms of what I want to do with Wolfgang, I think for me it's value creation and building a legacy of some sort in my own way. You know, like most people probably look at something and go, I want to build something with my kids and my future, you know, the future that I've had to build. I wasn't afforded, if you know what I mean. So it's kind of like, you know, I don't want to give things to my children, they'll work for it. But ultimately it's, you know, I want to kind of leave this planet at some point. You know, hopefully I'm lucky enough to hit bonus time at 65 and look back at it and go, well, at least I had a good fucking crack at it. You know, that's probably, you know, that's it really, without me kind of waffling on and getting all corny, I suppose.
No, that's great. I mean, at 32, you're executing at a high level. So that's really good to see. And I think you're doing things in a unique way. You're obviously a really honest and upfront guy, and I think the people listening are gonna hear that and take that away. And I enjoy the conversations that I've had with you. So thanks a ton for sharing. I mean, there's so much more to unpack here on some of the unique ways you structure deals and this partnership model. And maybe down the line, it'll be good to have you on, and we can kind of focus on one specific target and dig deeper into that, because I think you've touched on so many interesting topics here.
Yeah, I think for me, it's I like the idea of the community that you're trying to build. To be honest with you, Paul, there's something there in terms of pulling people together to kind of educate properly, if that makes sense. So like I said to you before, and revert back to these people trying to sell courses, you know, people are selling these silly courses for pretty much what you can learn on the internet, let's be honest. I think you've got something there where you could probably bring people together for minimal cost, really, to kind of educate people properly on how to do this if they're genuinely interested in what it is we've got to offer.
You're definitely not the first guest who's said that to me. I guess there is something in the works. Well, like I said, I'd love to have you on down the line and dig into some of these details. And I'll keep you posted when we get a few live events going on, because I'm sure people will love to meet you and chat about these things in person and likewise share insights with you. So thanks again, and look forward to chatting to you soon.
Lovely. Thanks for having us on, and all the best with your transaction. Let me know how you get on, if you need any help.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Buy and Build podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, please follow the show on your favorite podcast app to stay up to date on all new episodes. If you'd like to support the show, please share it with others you think might be interested.
You can also join the Buy and Build community at buyandbuild.co, where we plan to share additional resources and ideas with this community. You can also find us on Twitter at Buy and Build Podcast.